There is a story told of a king who had the most beautiful of beautiful daughters. And suitors would come throughout the kingdom, and the king didn't believe any of them were up to snuff, right? They were not enough. And so he devised a plan to figure out the bravest man in all the kingdom. So he invited all the men of the kingdom and even the surrounding kingdoms to his castle, where he had built a swimming pool about the size of the sanctuary. They walk in and he declares to them, "Anyone who can swim across the pool can marry my daughter and have half my kingdom." And then he snapped his finger and doors were lifted and crocodiles came into the pool. Well, it was dead silent. Nobody said a word or moved when suddenly there was a splash and a young man was in the pool swimming for his life. As the crocodiles converged on him, he went down and they went up and vice versa, left, right. There was a little blood in the water and lo and behold, he made it. The king was beside himself with joy. He came up to the young man and said, "You are the bravest man in all the kingdom. To you goes my daughter's hand in marriage. You are my son-in-law. Half my kingdom is yours." And he said, "That's all really good and well, Your Majesty. I just have one question." And the king said, "What's that?" And the young man said, "Who pushed me?" Now that's an old story and maybe some of you have heard it, but sometimes we need a push, don't we? We need a push for the opportunities that are before us, that we would seize them and do something with them. Now, I don't know if it's true of you, but for a number of people, now you got to hear this, it's difficult to imagine life as short. Okay? Life as short. I recognize when we're around tragedies and death and illness that we notice that, but we in America do a really good job of hiding death. We put it off to the peripheral, don't we? And we make it as though we'll live forever. And you know, psychologists tell us that young people, and this is not true of all, but one of the reasons they can be reckless at times is because they can't imagine that what they're doing is going to shorten their life. I mean, I was there once. I did my share of stupid things, and some of you might be in the middle of the stupid things, I don't know, or you can remember back. But we oftentimes can't conceive that life is short. Psalms 90, verse 12 says this, "Teach us to number our days aright, that we may gain a heart of wisdom." It's interesting, isn't it? Teach us to pay attention. And that's really what the author says right before this verse. That our life is fragile. But we don't always act as though it is fragile. We go on as if we are immortal in so many ways. Now, the average life expectancy is about 78 years in America today. That's the average. And there's a little smiley face. There's happy moments. It seems like a long time in the midst of that life, right? It doesn't seem all that short. Anybody know how old America is? 234 years, according to last July 4th. That's our birthday. Now, how does that make 78 years feel? Just think about that. Okay? Feels different, doesn't it? When you start, it starts to almost shrink a little. Now, 1517, Martin Luther nailed on the wall of Wittenberg Dor Church his 95 theses. This began what we call the Protestant Reformation. It's where we as people in Presbyterian churches come from. That was 493 years ago. How does that make 78 years feel? Kind of interesting, isn't it? And you know, the further back you go in time, the shorter who we are and our significance in life seems. It seems to shrink. It doesn't seem to grow. So Psalms 90, verse 12. "Teach us to number our days aright that we may gain a heart of wisdom." Wisdom comes as we count our days and we figure out what they count for. What do our days count for? Tony Campolo, who is a sociologist at Eastern University, this is not him, by the way, he's a speaker, a theologian, a pastor, and he told the story of Fyodor Dostoevsky. who is a 19th century Russian novelist. His most famous work is Crime and Punishment. Some people think he writes for Desperate Housewives, but I don't think that's true. He was a political prisoner to the Tsar of Russia. Okay? Political prisoners had a death sentence on their life. That was what happened when you were a political prisoner. Dostoevsky was marched into a plaza, blindfolded. Soldiers were there for the, and they were given the order, ready, aim, fire. There was an explosion from the weapons and nothing happened. The soldiers shot blanks. The goal of the Tsar was to actually not kill this batch or group of political prisoners, but to break their spirits. Break their spirits. Now, it did that to most of the men in that group, but what it did to Dostoevsky was just the opposite. It actually made him feel life in a brand new way. When he woke up that morning, he said that he ate his last meal as if it was his first meal. He tasted it in a brand new way. And when he drank water, it was like he had never drank water before. He breathed air and he felt it entering his lungs and exhaling. It was like brand new to him. As he was walking with the other prisoners to the plaza of execution, he saw the sky in a brand new way. And the grass was greener than it ever had been in his life. Birds, their beautiful song was brand new. Later, he would confess that he lived more that morning than he had lived his whole life. He had lived in a new way. And he would say, he would confess that life was never the same. Life was never the same for Dostoevsky. Now, Tony Campolo, after he tells this story, asks this question. How long have you lived this way? Seeing life brand new. Not taking for granted what is in front of you as if it's new. That's a great question, isn't it? How long have I lived life as if it's new? As if this is it, right? This is all I've got. And how I live now is everything. Is everything. Jeff Hamm was a young person, and I don't have a picture of him. I wish I did. In my youth group in Southern California back in the late 80s, early 90s. He was one of the most gifted young people I ever came to know. He was a straight-A student at Arcadia High School, which is in the top 5% of all high schools in America. Super challenging school. He lettered in football, soccer, baseball. Upon graduating, he went to Pomona College, just outside of Los Angeles, which is one of the most prestigious small private schools. There, he majored in political science and philosophy. It was a pre-law degree for him. He was a straight-A student once again. And his parents had great dreams for Jeff. Their dream was that he would become this attorney who would make a radical difference in the world. Jeff had different dreams. You see, his heart was turned to God. And he really felt this tug to become actually a youth pastor of all things. And his parents said, Jeff, why would you become a youth pastor? Anybody can do that. I did it for 25 years, okay? Why would you waste... They literally said that, your life, when you could do this amazing thing. Now, Jeff, in high school, he had an amazing faith. It wasn't like I had to teach him a whole lot. He was so hungry for God, and he shared his faith. In college, at Pomona College, it wasn't welcome to be a Christian, but Jeff shared his faith anyway. He wound up in Alaska, of all places, 1997, a youth pastor at a Presbyterian church. And there, he spent some time, and what he taught his youth, he had a saying that I never forgot. Life is short, eternity is long. Carpe diem. Carpe diem is Latin for seize the day. Okay? People get tattoos with this on. I mean, it's amazing. When I Googled carpe diem this week. So, life is short, eternity is long, carpe diem, seize the day. So Jeff began working with these young people, and he really emphasized this understanding that life is so short, it's so fragile. And in many ways, he embodied what Dostoevsky talked about, though he didn't know necessarily about Dostoevsky in that way. And he began to teach his young people that they had to make choices today that impacted their future and to seek life in its fullness now. Not wait. And seek it for God. Seek it for God. You never know when it's going to end, he would tell his kids. 1998, I did perform Jeff's funeral at Arcadia Presbyterian Church. There were some 600 folks that showed up for this 23-year-old. It was profound. Profound. The doctors think he died from Crohn's disease, but they're not actually positive. It was incredibly difficult, but I want you to understand something. Jeff lived out his convictions that life is short, eternity is long. He lived his life with passion and desire that others might come to know who God was and is. And you know, Jeff right now is very familiar with eternity is long. He gets it. And someday I'm going to get it with him. And I'm actually, not that I want to necessarily die and go to heaven right now, but I am excited to see Jeff again because of his life and what it spoke to so many people. He knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that life is about God. I mean, other things are fine, right? And they're all good, but they're not worth worshiping. They're not what makes life count. And Jeff lived that way. Life is short, eternity is long, seize the day. You know, many people live out the first part, life is short. They live it out, they eat dessert first. I had a friend who babysat our kids when they were younger, and she would encourage them to eat dessert for breakfast. It was just kind of funny, sort of. But we live this out, don't we? This notion that life is short. And so what do? People, I'm talking very general. People try to suck the life, literally suck dry life, don't they? And experience all they can because they don't know what tomorrow holds, but it's really not tied to this idea that eternity is long, right? It's just that life is short. So I better get it all and can it all right now, right? You know, I realize if all you have to do is watch TV for a little bit, and you see that. All you, this is Neil Young, by the way. And it was a little ahead, but I'll say it anyway. Sometimes people want to burn out than rest out, right? Neil Young's still alive, but he exemplifies that, doesn't he? Much better to burn out than to end up rusty someday. Now, all you have to do to notice this attitude is to read the paper a little bit. Watch TV just a little bit. It's pervasive in our culture, isn't it? Get it now, because you never know. You know, I'm 49, and it's gone very quick. It has gone so. When I was reflecting on Jeff Hamm, my friend, that was 1998. That was a long time ago, but it was just like that. You know, it's almost like my oldest sister went back to school yesterday. It was almost like January 1st he was born and the 9th he's 21, right? Today's 21. That's how quick it feels. And you know what I'm talking about when you reflect on your life. It goes so fast. So quick. Today, we have to hear this. Life is short. But there is a hope at the end of this life that goes on way beyond our wildest imagination about what hope comes for. That makes literally the things we go through here worth it in the end. I know they're challenging. I'm not denying that whatsoever. But in the end, we are called to seize the day for Jesus Christ. Now, I want you to put on your imagination goggles. Okay? That's what you have to do for just a few moments. It was an incredibly, unbearably hot day. Thousands of feet had gone down the path we were walking, and dust was in our noses, our hair. As the night came and we were exhausted, I could hear off in the distance the river God had spoken about, the River Jordan. And I was so excited about it because there were animals and people and families. We all needed it. And as we made camp that night, people were preparing their evening meals. I felt this nudge. I assumed it was God. And so I went walking into the night. As I went walking, really hoping it was God, I started to let my mind just kind of think and my feelings to rise up. And I was full of fear. You see, Moses had just left. Moses, who kind of had promised he'd see us through the whole way into the promised land. Well, God had kind of changed those plans, and Moses had left several days before. And Moses said, "You're kind of on your own." Kind of on your own. It was so intense, so scary. I mean, all these people, Moses was talking about people that were much better at whining and complaining than following God. And I was somehow to do something with these folks. This was crazy and so intensely scary. You know, my fear and apprehensions grew when the people began asking where we're going. And I had to kind of say this way, hoping that was God's way. In the midst of all my thoughts, my anxiety, my fears, a voice broke through like a voice I had never heard. And this is what he said. And God said, "Joshua, son of Nun, Moses, my servant, is dead. Now you and all these people get ready to cross the Jordan River into the land I am about to give to them. I will give you every place where you set your foot, as I promised Moses." Now, I realized really quickly this was God's voice. And I did trust God and believe in it, but this was beyond me. I mean, I was a slave in Egypt turned soldier, leader of the army. I sort of knew how to do that, but I didn't know what to do with these folks. People, children, livestock, how to do this. Then God's voice broke in with a little more intensity, and he said this, "As I was with Moses, I will be with you." You got to stop right there. As I was with Moses. Joshua had watched the plagues in Egypt. Joshua had watched the parting of the Red Sea. Joshua had watched manna every day for 40 years. As I was with Moses, God is saying, I will be with you, Joshua. I will be with you. And then God went on, "I will never leave you nor forsake you. Be strong and courageous, because you, Joshua, will lead these people to inherit the land I promised to their forefathers." God said again, "Be strong and courageous. Be careful to obey all I have given to you, and I will give you success in the land." And a third time, "Have I not commanded you? Be strong and courageous. Do not be terrified. Do not be discouraged. For I, the Lord your God, will be with you wherever you go." You know, those words, I believe, filled Joshua with hope. You notice God said, "Do not be terrified and discouraged," right? Why? Joshua was. He was fully over his head. It was beyond Joshua's wildest imagination that he would somehow lead these several million Israelites into the promised land. He could not imagine this at all, yet God could. And that is one of the good news for us, the pieces we can embrace. We can't imagine the future God is calling to us very well. Some of you might, but mine's pretty limited in my imagination. God's is not. And you notice that God did not, he said it three times, "Be strong and courageous," didn't he? Actually, the last time he said, "I'm commanding you, be strong and courageous." What a phrase. Command you to be strong and courageous. God, that's a little hard. Yet he did. And Joshua was. And he became. And you know, there are moments. I mean, they had the walls of Jericho, right? Pretty amazing story if you can read it. One of the most famous ones in Scripture. Then they had, which was a really great moment. Then they had this moment where they had to capture this little tiny fortress called Ai, and they totally failed. So Joshua had great moments, and he had terribly depressing moments. And I think he went back to this moment where God spoke. And God, he had to hear in his head, "Be strong and courageous, Joshua. I am with you. As I was with Moses." Right? That's what it says in verse 5. No one. This is so amazing. God saying to Joshua, no one will be able to stand against you all the days of your life. That is a promise, isn't it? What a promise. As I was with Moses, so I will be with you and I will never leave you nor forsake you. Now, I really believe we can claim much of that promise. I will never leave you nor forsake you. I think you can literally hang your hat on that promise that God is going to be faithful in those ways. I think he's calling us to literally claim what he said in so many ways to Joshua. Be strong. Be courageous. I'm with you. I'm with you. And Joshua seized the day, didn't he? He lived carpe diem. He went for it. And that's how he lived life. You know, we're in the beginning of a new year. And people make resolutions and all those kinds of things. And it's some ways it's kind of strange, isn't it, that we would do it at the beginning of the year? Because it's artificial in a sense, right? Here it is, January. It doesn't always feel like the middle of the year. September, for me, almost feels more like new things. But here we are, starting. God is calling to us. He's calling to us. He's not saying you're going to have to lead a nation. He's not saying you're going to have to face a firing squad. He's not saying you need to go to Alaska to be a youth director, right? He's not saying any of those things, but he is calling to you and me that we would make our lives count beyond ourselves. He is calling us to live for him in a unique way. Jeremiah 29:11 is one of my favorite verses in all of Scripture. God is telling Israel, and he's speaking to us, "For I know the plans I have for you." Isn't that good news? God has plans. You're not just on a ship floating in some ocean all on your own. God has plans. And those plans are to prosper you and not to harm you. Plans to give you a hope and a future. Now, every single person has a future. We all do, both in this life and the next one to come. Every person does. But for those that seek and follow God, God has plans. He is paying attention to you. And I find that almost scary and shocking and exciting all at once, that God would notice me. He would notice you and have plans for us. And they're plans full of hope. Plans full of hope, wherever they may lead. And God is really calling us to live with all our hearts for him. Because as he was with Joshua, he will be with you. As he was with Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, he will be with you. As he was with David, Solomon, Isaiah, we just read Jeremiah. As he was with Mary and Joseph, who we just kind of talked about their story for a number of weeks, right? In that crazy incarnation moment, he'll be with us. As he was with those amazing, incompetent, yet open disciples, right? He will be with us. And you know, those incompetent disciples, when you read their stories, turned the world upside down. Those 11 men changed everything with the Spirit, with God. With God. If we follow after God, this is what I believe, we will experience Jeremiah 29:11. It will be a part of who we are. Now, every single person seizes the day. You know that. We put our lives into something. May not be for good things, may be very selfish, but every single person seizes the day in some capacity, pouring their life into it. When your life and my life is done, an enormous question, what will it count for? What will our lives count? They'll count for something, I promise you. Maybe a few people will notice, maybe a large number of people will notice. Will it represent what we believe is most important in life by how we live? There's a man by the name of James Lewis Pettigrew. He was so commendable, so amazing in his community that when he died, they created an epitaph for him. And this is what it said. Unawed by opinion, unseduced by flattery, undismayed by disaster, he confronted life with courage and death with Christian hope. Now there is a man who lived carpe diem. His whole community noticed, paid attention, and honored him that we would even read it today. I would be just happy if a little bit was written about me, right? Just a little. There is coming a day when we will all experience life is short. And I'm not trying to depress you. Just saying it's true. It's reality. You know, again, we hide those things. Eternity is long. Eternity is long. So God calls us today to seize it, to make the most of what we have been given. Now, every single one of us has something pretty neat. We have 1,440 minutes every day. Do you know that? Every single person has 1,440 minutes a day. You don't get to take it with you. You know that. Tomorrow comes and today is gone. As so many songs and poets and movies have talked about, right? You can't invest it, put it in the bank and hope to redeem it, in a sense, tomorrow. So how are we going to use today? How are you going to use it? And if this is true, wouldn't it make sense that we would commit it to the one, the Savior and the Creator and the Lord of life, Jesus? And wouldn't it make sense also that if this is true, we only have today to use this time, that we would want to live it in such a way that it would live beyond the day? Hope that makes sense to you. My friend Jeff lived his life, and I'm talking about him today. He lived beyond himself for something far greater than himself, God. And I want to challenge you to really think about living our lives in such a way that they would impact others, that would carry forth, carry more. Now, it's not as if things aren't important, by the way. You still have to work, you still have to live. But in the midst of living and working and relationships, I want to challenge you to think, how can I conduct myself in such a way that I would impact those? Impact those. In the words of my friend Jeff, life is short, eternity is long. Seize the day. I want to share one last story, and then we're going to be quiet and hopefully listen to the nudgings that Joshua experienced. Several years back in a city called Timișoara, Romania, lived a man named Laszlo Tokes. He was a pastor of a small Hungarian Reformed church, pretty small. Laszlo Tokes began to preach about Jesus in a way that the folks had not heard, apparently, because it was a small church and it exploded over the next 2 years into a church of 5,000. Incredible. And understand something. That might be really wonderful in America, but in Romania, which was communist at the time, it was not wonderful. Because the government began to pay attention. And they began to send soldiers to intimidate people attending the church services, hoping to cause them not to come. And they actually sent, they hired some folks to come and really intimidate Laszlo Tokes and his family. And they took away, they confiscated their ration forms so that they couldn't buy food or fuel, couldn't even heat their home. Their church began to help out, making it so that it worked. December of 1989, the government decided to exile Laszlo Tokes and his family. They came on December 15th. The police came and arrived at their church where the parish was and they lived. And what the soldiers found, the police, was shocking, because hundreds and hundreds of people had come because they had found out what was happening. And they formed like a human barrier around this church. Well, the police didn't break in that day. And the people knew that if they left, most likely their pastor would be taken. So they spent the night. A 19-year-old student named Daniel Javara had brought candles, a lot of foresight, and began to pass them out. And there they were lit. And the story tells that Laszlo Tukes, from his home, looked out the window and saw hundreds and hundreds of candles for him. And he was stunned because they weren't all people from his church, from many other churches. And he recognized that the kingdom of God is much bigger than anything we can imagine. Now, through the course of the night, police kind of infiltrated the crowd. And as dawn came around, they broke into the house. And they handcuffed the family and led them out. You know, it looked like the end. But what happens is so fascinating. Religious protest often leads to political protest. They're tied in so many ways when justice is at the heart of the matter. And what happened is that hundreds and even thousands of people poured into the square at Timisoara City. And the government responded in violence, sending soldiers in, and over 100 people were shot, including Daniel Javara, that 19-year-old young man. Prior to that, he had passed out candles once again, and people were standing in like a vigil for freedom. Now, what happened as a result of that violent attack on those folks is that the people of Romania rose up. And within 5 days, the nation was free. Ceausescu was overthrown, the communist leader. And for the first time in 50 years, they had a Christmas that was free, to literally celebrate God in a way that they had not been able to prior to that. Daniel Javara ended up in the hospital, having been shot. He actually lost his leg, and he was learning on Christmas Eve how to walk with crutches. And his pastor said, "Oh, Daniel, I'm so sorry." And Daniel said, "Pastor, why? This leg, it's nothing. I was the one who lit the first candle. The candle that freed Romania." Folks, God is calling us to seize the day. You never know what one candle will do you? You don't know. And God is calling us to not necessarily start a revolution, lead people, millions of people to the promised land, go to Alaska. He's not necessarily calling us to do that, but He is calling us to live for Him, to let Jeremiah 29:11 emerge in our lives, that He has plans and they're good. They are for our prosperity, for our hope. They're for the best. And He's calling us to live differently today. Today. He's calling us to live our lives different tomorrow, this next week, this next month, the month of January 2011. He's calling us to live differently this year, 2011, to live our lives in such a way that they make a difference. Seize the day. Seize the day. Let's be quiet and listen for the voice of God.